This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Hard on the fluoride issue and on the vote on that issue. I have not changed my position. We're giving the issue a break this week. Next week, we will have further expertise on the implications of the adoption of the poisonous kind of fluoride that's going to be put into our water system, our pure water system. So I think that I want to remind everybody that it's really important that you reach out to everyone you know, make sure they're voting in this election in May, make sure they're well informed, and make sure that you're well informed. So next week, more fluoride. This week, much more important, perhaps national, international stuff, led by Abe. And I have to announce a very, very, very important thing. If you care at all about KBOO, there is a special meeting pursuant to, I'm going to read this to you, ORS 65.204 and Article 5, as in V, something 2 of the KBOO Foundation bylaws. The Board of Directors of the KBOO Foundation hereby notifies the general membership, that's you and you, of a special membership meeting, a little fast, but anyway, it's going to happen, to be held at Tabor Space at 1 p.m. this Saturday, May 4th, for the stated purpose of holding a discussion regarding the current changes, which I don't even know about. I don't know nothing about them. Changes occurring at KBOO.
So if you're a KBOO member, this meeting is for you.
It really is. And if you care at all about the station, you really, really need to be at that meeting. So 1 o'clock, Saturday, May 4th, at the Tabor Space, which is 5441 Southeast Belmont. And you really, if you care about the station, whatever your opinions, whatever, they're welcome, they're needed. It's now's the time.
Yeah.
So I hope people hear this, and I hope people will show up at that meeting.
Yeah, me too.
And I don't know enough about what's going on to talk about what's going on.
But you've teased it now. People
I've
are curious.
I've teased it, as they say in the industry.
In the industry.
You've been teased. Oh, indie media. Indie.
All right. This has been a really lousy month.
Oh, come on.
Oh, it's true.
The flowers are blooming.
Yeah, all that's fine.
Sun is showing up.
There were bombs.
Japan, the nuclear power plants have groundwater leaking constantly into them, which is being bombarded with strontium. And it's been very likely to leak into the Pacific Ocean. How can you say things are lousy?
But that's not so good.
No.
All right, so these bombs went off in Boston on April the 15th.
Yeah, a couple of them. Kettle bombs.
And then not too long after a fertilizer plant exploded in Texas.
Yeah, a fertilizer plant, but, you know, not inspected for a long, long time.
And then
more fertilizer than it ought to have.
Then Congress ignored the opinion of 90% of the American public and failed to take any action on guns.
Yeah.
And then the House passed the next iteration of SOPA. This time it's called CISPA.
What was SOPA? CISPA what?
SOPA was a bill voted on last year that would have essentially removed privacy rights from the internet. CISPA is its most recent incarnation, passed out of committee in the House of Representatives, actually passed the full House of Representatives and has now gone to the Senate. This would allow information sharing between corporations about your private information.
I think they already do that.
Private sharing between corporations and the government.
Ah.
Yeah. This would essentially whittle away what little First and Fourth Amendment privacies remain to you online. So in a sense, this is a mirror of what's happening in the real world where very, very few of our First and Fourth Amendment protections remain.
Ah.
But most of the reason why I say this has been a largely lousy month stems from the bombing in Boston. The bombing in Boston has exposed once again the devil's bargain that we made after the September 11th attacks.
Explain what you're saying.
When the September 11th attacks came along, there was an immediate and knee-jerk reaction here in the United States, much of which was understandable, I think, on a visceral level. This terrorist attack occurred. People were angry. People were scared. People felt injured. People felt violated. There was among the preponderance of the populace, it must be said, desire for retribution and for vengeance. It was called justice at the time, but let's not mince words.
Well, you know, why do they hate us for our freedom?
It was vengeance.
Yes.
So in that chaotic period after the September 11th attacks, we made what amounts to a Faustian bargain. We agreed, through our representatives in Congress, to forego some of our constitutional freedoms, theoretically, in exchange for a greater degree of safety. And I think we can all agree that that really didn't work.
So we don't have particular safety, and we lost some freedoms.
We don't have particular safety, and we lost some freedoms. Indeed, I think you can say definitively now that we are less free than we were before the September 11th attacks. And if, as you flippantly said, they hate us for our freedoms, they ought to like us much better now because we ain't as free as we used to be. Now, are we?
Well, that means we've lost the war on terror.
Essentially, yes. That's what it means.
Well,
if one could win a war on a noun in the first place.
Well, a war on drugs.
A war on a feeling. Yeah, well, exactly. I'm glad you brought up the war on drugs. Let's talk about the Fourth Amendment for a moment. Okay?
I don't know nothing about the Fourth Amendment.
The Fourth Amendment is what protects you from illegal searches and seizures, protects you from being deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
Right.
It is among the most important of the first 10 amendments in terms of guaranteeing personal liberty in the face of government largesse. Largesse probably isn't the right word.
No, largesse isn't the right word.
Government overreach.
Government power.
Government power.
Power.
Power. The Fourth Amendment. Far more important than the Second Amendment, I might add, is the Fourth Amendment.
Well, the Second Amendment doesn't say what most people think it does, but never mind.
Right, but the Second Amendment is invoked as a great guarantor of our individual freedoms. In fact, the ultimate guarantor.
Right.
When the man is knocking at your door.
I can shoot him.
You can freaking shoot him.
Right.
But
you can't.
That apocalyptic fantasy aside, the Fourth Amendment is far more important. The Fourth Amendment is what sets us apart from the autocratic, monarchical regimes that typified governments at the time of the American Revolution.
Right.
If you are accused of a crime, you may not be detained without being charged with that crime.
Right.
You must be allowed access to counsel.
Right. Well, that was a recent decision, actually, the access to counsel, the specific aspect of it. But go ahead.
Right. You are guaranteed access to counsel.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot have your property confiscated, your liberty confiscated. You cannot be executed without first undergoing a swift and public trial in which you are allowed to face your accusers and being judged based on the weight of the evidence at hand.
Mm-hmm.
All of this is embodied to a greater or lesser extent in the Fourth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with the war on drugs, the Fourth Amendment has been gradually eroded like the drip, drip, dripping of water on stone. There goes the Fourth Amendment. Even before September 11th, in drug cases in many instances, you could have your property confiscated without due process. Then September 11th attacks happened, and we gave up an even larger chunk of the First Amendment. Enemy combatants, you've heard that term.
Mm-hmm.
That was under the auspices of the Patriot Act, this massive piece of legislation that was rushed through Congress in that immediate panicky period following the September 11th attacks. Nobody really even paused to question why this piece of legislation already existed, waiting to be voted upon.
And most people didn't read it, turns out.
Most people didn't read it. You can now be detained indefinitely without being charged with a crime in the United States of America.
Apparently, you can now be droned to death.
You can now be droned to death without due process of law. You can now be detained without access to counsel. You can be detained without being charged with a crime. You are no longer entitled to the due process protections embodied in the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States as a result of the legislation and executive actions that promulgated in the wake of the September 11th attacks. So what happened after Boston on April 15th of this year? That was exposed for all to see. As soon as these attacks occurred, a cry went up from the right wing to treat these the perpetrators, whoever they might have been. This was before we had any idea who they might have been, as enemy combatants. And as soon as that designation is laid down, as soon as someone is called an enemy combatant, they are no longer entitled to the constitutional protections that you and I take for granted, or at least used to take for granted. And then it turned out that the only surviving perpetrator was, in fact, an American citizen. And the calls to treat him as an enemy combatant still were being made from the right, from all over the place. I don't care if he's a citizen. treat him as an enemy combatant. He was arrested under the auspices of what's called a public safety exception to the Miranda rule. Now, you know what the Miranda rule is.
Yeah, you know.
What is the Miranda rule?
Well, you got to be informed of your crime, and you have to be informed of your right to an attorney.
Right.
And you have to be informed you don't have to talk.
There's something called the public safety exception to the Miranda rule. It means that if there is what the government believes to be a clear and present danger to the public, somebody can be detained for a period of indeterminate period of time before due process is instigated. This guy was arrested under the public safety exception. He was not Mirandized until much after the fact. He was not allowed access to counsel until much after the fact. This was without even invoking the enemy combatant declaration, which, to the government's credit, they ultimately did not invoke. But let's pause and think here a moment. Had we not made that devil's bargain after the September 11th attacks, would we be in this situation now? Would we be reacting to this the way we are now?
Well, a good test is this: the bombing in Oklahoma. Right?
The bombing in Oklahoma,
where McVeigh is that his name? Yeah,
McVeigh
was clearly part of a conspiracy, and we didn't invoke it there.
No, we did not invoke it there. Nor did we invoke by proxy and by association the guilt of his compatriots, people who looked like, thought like, believed like McVeigh. In other words, we did not go around claiming that we had a white Christian terrorist problem.
I always thought we had a white Christian terrorist problem.
Well, I have too, but that's beside the point.
Yes.
After September 11th, it was widely proclaimed that we had a brown Muslim terrorist problem.
Ah, Muslim.
And after this attack, the perpetrator of which was, in fact, a Muslim American, it was once again proclaimed that we have a Muslim terrorist problem.
Right. Of course, he's a white Muslim.
Yeah, he's a white Muslim.
Yeah.
But just barely.
Well,
you know.
Russian.
Yeah, well.
Sort of Russian.
So the question that I put to you today, listeners, is that what do we do to address this current state of affairs? We now live, whether you like it or not. Now, you might say, who cares? Who cares, Abe, about the Fourth Amendment? Who cares about the erosions thereof? Who cares about the First Amendment and the erosions thereof? If you keep your nose clean, if you're not a terrorist, you don't have anything to worry about. As long as you're not one of them, you ain't got nothing to worry about. What's the problem?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I submit to you, listeners, that we now live in a situation where our de facto constitutional rights are transitory. They are not permanent. They are subjective. They can be abrogated if somebody's really pissed off or somebody's really scared. They no longer have the universal inviolability that they once had. And that is a slippery slope away from democracy towards something much, much more ugly.
Oh, light a doobie and cool out.
If only. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Jamie, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm calling about the special membership meeting on Saturday, part of a committee to keep KABU KABU. And anyone can show up. You don't have to be a member because it's not actually an official membership meeting. It's more like a forum. So if you support KABU, come. But, of course, you should join.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there because we've decided before the show we're not going to talk about the substance of that meeting on this program.
Uh-huh. Well, if anyone wants to find out, they can give me a call.
Well, wait a minute. I disagree with Abe on this. I think we can let listeners talk about it. We can't talk about it. So you go ahead.
So I'm very concerned about the values at KABU, the values of democracy, human rights that we've been talking about, because it seems that an autocratic, anti-democratic change is happening at KABU, where staff members are being threatened with layoffs and there's union busting in the air. So if people want to keep KABU KABU, please show up. And if you want to hear more, call me at 503-752-5112.
Is that, could you repeat that number?
503-752-5112. And it's the committee to keep KABU KABU.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I'm sorry. I contradicted
no,
what we agreed to. I just wanted to have some sense of what. I have to explain something. I do. I have to make a confession. I am a person who comes to KABU and does a show and has conversation with colleagues, but gets the hell out. I've kind of eschewed board meetings and programming committee meetings and
yeah,
all that.
I'm in
stuff.
The same boat.
And we both are guilty of this. And it's guilty, it turns out, because there are maybe changes afoot. But because both of us know nothing, we are being extremely defensive.
Circumspect
around this issue. That doesn't mean that you out there can't raise the issue. That's why I had that call go through.
Okay. Who's next, Steve? Jeremy, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to offer a little bit of, perspective on the tragedy in Boston.
Sure.
The amount of time that it takes to say tragedy in Boston, somebody starves to death entirely unnecessarily or dies of dehydration. The absolute minimum figure for the number of child deaths per day is considered to be 5,000, which would be less than 2 million a year. Many people think it's 5 or 10 times that. But at 2,000 deaths, that's about a couple of minutes. So I'm sorry, you have to say tragedy in Boston and talk about it for a paragraph or two, and then a couple of kids starved or dehydrated to death.
Yeah, there's irony and bitterness in your conversation with us, I sense.
Well, I feel that people should understand what's, sort of the magnitude of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the tragedy in Boston was a tragedy that happens every single second to somebody that doesn't have a name, that didn't manage a movie theater, that wasn't, an MIT cop. There's some unnamed, usually not white, person on the other side of the world, and that because Obama's buddies with the people who own Cargill or speculate in grain futures or actually enjoy the fact that people are starving to death or really don't care. And we can all, this is all entirely unnecessary.
I agree with you.
It would take global social revolution, but in the absence of that, it's going to continue.
Yes, I would agree with you, absolutely. But the context I was trying to set here by invoking the Boston attacks was that they represent and lay bare the erosion of the constitutional freedoms that we've experienced here over the past 10 years or so. This is not to denigrate the plight of anybody that you've mentioned in your phone call.
I didn't think you were denigrating. I just think we constantly lose perspective. Because the truth is overwhelmingly horrible. If you think about it, oh, my God, somebody else is dehydrating. What are we supposed to do with that?
Well,
I honestly don't know, but I refuse to talk about fucking Boston. Excuse my language.
I'm sorry. We're gonna have to let you go.
All right. Thanks, Ron.
All right. Bye-bye. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. He raises a very good point. I mean, you could say one of the three fatalities in the Boston bombings was an 8-year-old kid waiting for his dad to cross the finish line at the Boston Marathon. Now, that's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Earlier in the month, a drone strike in Pakistan, I want to say, killed something like a dozen children who were then classified by that most pristine of terms, collateral damage.
No, they're brown skinned and they're foreign.
You're right.
They talk a different language and they have a different religion,
Indeed, and he's right that we shouldn't invoke the tragedy of one kid's death in Boston without similarly considering the deaths of those kids in Pakistan. The horrible truth of the situation, and this again, I think, arises in the post-September 11th era, although one could argue, and I think probably quite convincingly, that it predates September 11th, is that to a certain extent, those deaths in Pakistan are not surprising. Whereas the death of that kid in Boston is surprising in a way those deaths in Pakistan are not.
Well, I think part of what happens in America is a kind of psychology of denial, generally. We are seen by ourselves as the good guys of history, the democratic and little d sense of history. We ignore, for example, the fact that in Guantanamo, people are being force-fed. They're on a hunger strike. They're demanding religious freedoms. They're demanding a release for those who are absolutely have nothing, you know, a lot of those people were sent there because they were being the people who sent them there were their old angry neighbors or people who could make money off of turning them in. It's a dreadful thing. The president had promised as part of his initial campaign for presidency to dump Guantanamo. He could have and still could by executive order do that. He has not done that. I think Guantanamo is, in a way, kind of merges all the and represents in a small event the horrors of the current time and situation. And the fact that the American people seem either unaware or indifferent to the plight of those people because they're Muslim, because they're foreigners, whatever, is, to me, extremely disturbing.
It is, yes. Let me clarify the claim I made just a moment ago. According to the Afghan government, a NATO air attack on April 6th killed 17 civilians in Kunar province, 12 of whom were children. So it happened in Afghanistan, not in Pakistan. And the Afghan government is claiming it's an air attack. They don't specify whether it was a drone attack or a manned aircraft attack.
I'm not sure it matters.
I'm not sure it matters. I just wanted to be accurate.
Well, and I also think that we do need to understand that drone attacks happen all over the Horn of Africa. The drone attacks happen all over Pakistan and Afghanistan. The drone attacks also have happened elsewhere. There are drones being used in Latin America. This is the new technology of murder.
It is. It is. What I want to make clear and what I want to talk to our listeners about today is that I can sit here today, I think, and state unequivocally that since the September 11th attacks, a culture of fear has been carefully cultivated here in our country, such that first we have been convinced to abrogate and give away some of our cherished constitutional protections that have existed in one form or another since the country was founded, and two, to be so concerned with our own safety and the inviolability of the homeland. What a strange term that is.
The homeland.
Yes, indeed. That we are, for the most part, indifferent to the suffering caused to innocents by our own military actions abroad.
Well, I take a larger perspective. We murdered the Native Americans.
We did.
Okay. We ripped off a third of Mexico.
We did.
Took over the Philippines and had a war on against the Philippine independence movement and tortured people and used waterboarding, interestingly, during that that event at the turn of the 20th century.
Yep.
We have not been the good guys we play at.
No.
So maybe this is just a continuation of a bad pattern of imperialism and inner imperialism that comes to fruition in a modern technological situation of drones and so on.
Well, perhaps, but I also submit to you that a populace more concerned with its liberties and the liberties of people everywhere and less concerned with fear-mongering and concerns over its own safety is a populace more likely to stand up for the rights of the 12 kids in Afghanistan who were killed by a NATO airstrike.
Oh, I agree with you, but, you know, to me it's inexplicable the fact that our politics have become so right-wing that and so identified with I don't know what you want to call it, with odd notions of liberalism, that a guy like Obama, who has proven himself to be now clearly ideologically at best non-ideological and at worst essentially part of the right, gets away with not doing any of the things he promises and doing very bad things, in fact. And we, all of us, are left with him, the liberal quandary. We're left with him because there ain't no other choice. No left-wing parties in America that amount to anything. Only right-wing parties, and the right-wing party of the Republicans moving steadily into a hyper-fascist mood. This is a very serious situation, but it's historically not unsurprising.
No, but by the same token, very, very disappointing.
Yeah.
503-231-8187. Ed, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Yeah.
Well, you're sounding like a couple subversives.
Oh, I hope so.
That
I
happens.
Like it. I really like it. Hey, anyway, I wanted to say a little something about the Boston bomber situation.
Sure.
You know, the following week or maybe a couple weeks after that, I was watching This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent the majority of his program just asking the question, when did these two boys become radicalized? And, you know, I thought, I wonder why more people in America, or why all of America hasn't been become radicalized. I mean, with all the things that are going on in the world, and, you know, at the hands, well, many of the things that you guys just mentioned. Do you see where I'm going with this?
I do see where you're going. Why, for example, why aren't more Americans more agitated about the injustices being meted out with our tax dollars all over the world? And why aren't more Americans agitated about the fact that we are less free than we were even 10 years ago?
Oh, not only that, but all the young people in America especially, I mean, their future has been spent on these two wars. Trillions of dollars. And we'll never pay those debts. I mean, these kids will be paying on those debts for probably the next 50 years.
And part of the irony of that is the excuse of, I think, a very conscious plan, beginning with Ronald Reagan, to spend America's wealth on essentially a war development and war activity has essentially made it impossible for us to be a social democracy.
Yeah. It's like, where do you start talking about an involvement? I mean, when we talk about Iran, most of the time we talk about the hostage situation, mm-hmm. without going a little earlier and saying, well, what about the overthrow of their democracy? We talk about Cuba and, you know, sanctions. We talk about Korea, but we don't talk about how we wiped out their industrial base, and how we have sanctions against them, just like we do against Cuba. One other thing that I wanted to mention was about the gun control, and just very briefly, you know, they're talking about taking our guns away, and a lot of people say, well, you know what, if the United States wants to take your guns away or have martial law, they're going to do it. Well, then my question is, then why are we talking about sending guns to Syrian opposition groups? Okay, anyway, thanks a lot, guys.
All right. That's a rhetorical question. I'm not going to answer it.
Okay.
All right, some business.
Yes, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, alternative radio host David Barsamian interviews Yves Engler about what's going on in Canada. Eh?
Hey.
At 10, here, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, an interview with Charlie Kernaghan of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights on the rising death toll for the Bangladesh garment factory collapse. How you liking them jeans?
Oh, I
America?
Love my jeans, and they're so cheap.
And an interview with former bank consultant and longtime thrift watchdog Tim Anderson about reports that Obama is poised to nominate subprime Queen Betty Pritzker to be the next Secretary of Commerce.
Subprime Queen?
Subprime Queen sounds like a designation you'd find on certain sectors of the internet. At 11 on Stage and Studio, D. May Roberts talks with author Ursula K. Le Guin, director Jonathan Walters, and actor Damian Thompson about a new original stage adaptation of Le Guin's novel, The Left Hand of Darkness.
Which is a great novel.
It is. By Portland Playhouse and Hand to Mouth Theater. I bet that's going to be a good play.
I'm going to go to that play.
And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Ava Lake interviews Patrick Collier. He has a show at Place right now. He also writes for Oregon Arts Watch and other publications. All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
Yeah, and I want to quickly repeat a couple of things. I want to remind you that it's really important that you vote in this upcoming May election. The question of fluoridation, particularly with some nasty chemicals, is on the ballot, and you need to participate, and you need to contact other people, and you need to get out there. There's a huge amount of money on the pro-fluoride side and very sincere people there who I think are wrong. But you need to get involved in that. Next week, we'll be talking about that again. And we want to remind you of the special meeting notice this Saturday. You really, whether you're a member or not, really need to go to this meeting. It's going to be very important for the future of KBOO. It's this Saturday, May 4th, at 1 o'clock at the Tabor Space, which is 5441 Southeast Belmont. And if you are not there, you are very square. An old thing.
All right, one more piece of biz here. Tune in tonight at 6 for the fourth in a 12-part series of Tune In, Turn On, Remember. 45 great years of KBOO community radio. During this episode, we speak with Shahid Hamid about being a programmer on KBOO since 1980.
Woo.
In addition, we'll remember the master blaster, George Page.
George Page, an old friend.
45 years.
Whoa.
That's something.
That is really something, and it's always struggled, and it's always survived.
Indeed it has.
You know, I was at the first, I think it was the first, who knows, meeting of people gathered at the Merchants of Warren Social Service Agency in the Lair Hill neighborhood to discuss creating a radio station, I think on the model of Crab in Seattle.
Huh.
Way back. This was 1968.
When? Oh, my.
Yeah.
You're older than me.
I am older than you.
All right.
How old were you in 1968?
I was not. I was negatively aged.
Oh, God.
I was a mere thought.
I feel so ancient. All right.
All right. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. I'm Abe. That's Joe. By inference, this is the Abe and Joe talk radio program. Today, we're talking about the post-September 11th climate and what it has meant to our constitutional liberties. Reaching a bit larger, we're talking about how the Boston attacks in particular have exposed that. And I also want to touch on another aspect of this terrible, horrible, no good, very bad month of April here in the United States, which has some similar themes, and that is the explosion of the fertilizer plant in Texas.
Kaboom!
Little town of West Texas.
Well, you know, in Texas, we do things our own way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It turns out it's dangerous. The ammonium nitrate fertilizer plant blew up, killed at least 15 people. It has injured, at last count, more than 200.
What's your problem with that? That's Texas, man.
Well, here's my problem with that. Reuters is reporting that the factory had been storing 1,350 times the amount of ammonium nitrate that would normally have triggered safety oversight by the federal government.
You want government interfering in Texas?
I do. Here's why. 1,350 times the amount of that that now blew up and has killed at least 15 people. Now, here's an interesting twist on that. Why not send safety inspectors in, you might be wondering.
Why not send safety inspectors
in? Because of budget and personnel cutbacks at the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA.
Yeah.
This is according to Bill Moyers. It would take, to inspect every worksite in Texas, it would take 98 years.
Whoa.
For current OSHA staffing levels to make sure that every worksite in Texas is safe.
And that's not an accident. I think it's not an accident. Where the Republican Party is doing, what it's doing is cutting the ability of the administration to administer just the ordinary programs, never mind things that need to be done beyond that.
Indeed. When Grover Norquist said, I want to shrink government down to the size I can drown it in a bathtub, this is what he means. You make budget cuts in the name of the almighty need to narrow the deficit, the almighty need to avoid more debt, which amazingly vanishes whenever Republicans happen to be in power. But in the name of budget cutting, you cut staff and you cut budgets at organizations like OSHA. You cut meat inspection budgets. You cut safety inspection budgets of all kinds. And then you end up having problems like this. And then when an economic period of economic duress rolls around, like the one we're in now, then you cut it even more. And then you sit back and you cluck and you wonder why. Do we have fertilizer plants blowing up in Texas?
Well, there's
your answer.
Well, it's really important to understand that this whole notion of shrinking government to deal with a depression is absolutely economically wrong.
It is absolutely economically
wrong.
And that,
in fact, the data upon which it was based, a couple of Harvard economists, was faulty. And all of Europe and the United States are engaging in faulty thinking based on faulty data, which continues to be the dominant idea in the Congress of the United States and the administration.
If you want a very clear explanation of why governments need to spend more during recession rather than less, read Paul Krugman's column from yesterday in the Times.
Yes.
He lays it out brilliantly. So here we have a situation where, A, we are less free than we used to be because we live in constant fear of terror.
Terror.
And we're involved in a war without end that allows the commander-in-chief to designate whomever he pleases as an enemy combatant, that enables him to assassinate you wherever you happen to be without due process of law, where you no longer enjoy the protections of counsel, all the protections enumerated in the Fourth Amendment, where you no longer enjoy the extent of First Amendment rights that you used to have. And on top of this, we have a government regulatory structure that has been so completely eroded that we are unable to protect ourselves in the workplace and at a very basic level.
Yeah, but you get really cool big explosion.
This is a recipe for decline, and it is not an accident.
Yeah, but you get a really big cool explosion.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. Karen, good morning.
Good morning. Well, you know, you guys, you lay out all the problems really, really well. And one of the earlier callers talked about, you know, people getting out in the street and why that doesn't happen and all that. And, you know, there are a lot of groups. I'm involved in a couple of different groups and, you know, doing different things. May Day, there'll be a big...
Oh, yeah, I want to mention that there's going to be a big demo on May Day.
Yeah, and, you know, we're doing a float. Oregon is doing a float. We're working on that tonight.
Hey, I gotta interrupt you just for a second because I need to know, when does that start and where does it start, the May Day demo?
Yeah, it's in the afternoon. So well, there's going to be a lot going on. You know, people are down there in the afternoon, you know, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock.
Where?
Go to the weareoregon.org site. That would be the best.
I think we need somebody to call us and give us the details of that.
Yes, that would be good. And I apologize for not having that.
That's okay.
I'm working on the float.
Float's good.
Yeah. But, you know, I think about this a lot, too. And I think people are just stretched so thin. And, you know, we're trying to survive. We're paying huge mortgages. And we've got, you know, 2013 expenses, and we're trying to pay it with $1,970.
Mm.
You know, it's just, I think people they're stressed, they're worried, and there are so many things, which, you know, you just outlined really well, so many areas that we need to fight. And I feel like, you know, we're on the defensive. And I wish there was some way to be more proactive and more, you know, put things out there, but I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how that would happen.
Well, I think people, particularly younger people, have got to realize the dangers that they face economically as well as in terms of freedoms. They got to get out. They got to get out in the streets. They got to get out in the letter writing, the email, the activities of participation in the system. Democracy is not easy. Democracy takes a lot of work. And we've been taught as a society that everything's cool.
Right. Well, and, you know, it's funny because I know in France and, you know, a lot of places in Europe, drop of a hat, people are on the street.
Well, in fact, Europe is in turmoil because the austerity programs are destroying the social service programs that made social democracy so important and significant and successful in the post-war era in Europe.
I have a question for you guys. I'd be really interested to know, you know, what your thoughts are on this. And you know, that is, you know, when we look at the financial problem and, you know, austerity and all that, you know, you can kind of follow it through. You can use critical thinking and say, okay, well, you know, what are the consequences of this? And think about, you know, who benefits, follow the money, that kind of thing. But, you know, when we're thinking about a lot of these political things that are happening, what's the benefit? Who benefits if we just don't have any more democracy? I mean,
well, you know, as long as there's a consumer culture, it's obvious that the manufacturing investment class both benefit.
But that can't last.
Well, I mean, no, nothing, of course, could last forever. But
I think it can last for a good long time.
I think you can. I can imagine it lasting another 50, maybe 100 years.
The emerging transnational ownership class, which I think is really calling the shots in global capitalism today, is here. It is. I'm going to lay it out for you right now. Is willing to trade a couple hundred million middle class American consumers for a few billion emerging middle class Indian and Chinese consumers.
In other words,
we don't matter anymore. National borders are irrelevant. Capital can travel wherever it needs to on the globe in the blink of an eye. It can go to wherever labor is the cheapest, wherever environmental regulation is the least prevalent. It doesn't matter. You and I don't matter anymore.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt now to give everyone information about the May Day March. Okay?
Okay.
First of all, you understand May Day now is kind of a merging of the immigrant rights movement and the labor movement, and had its traditional origins in the labor movement, and is an international holiday except in the U.S. Okay, May Day. you gather at 2 p.m. at O'Brien Square, which is 9th and Stark, and rally at 3, and then march at 4. And it's calling for all manner, International Worker Day, no human being is illegal, people over profit, a huge number of demands, all of them reasonable. If you have time, If you have the free movement of yourself and others, if you want to bring your kids, this is a peaceful, nonviolent, kind of colorful parade. It begins with a rally at 3 at O'Brien Square, and then a march at 4. It's very cool. I've always enjoyed the May Day marches, even when the police rioted against us back in, what was it, 99. I mean, I think this is an event to go to. Enough said. That event is very important. The other one, for anyone who cares about KBOO, is the special meeting that takes place this Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont.
I think we lost our caller, which is too bad. That was a good call.
She was good. I didn't mean to.
So thank you, caller, very much. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. Carl, you're up next.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
A phrase I did not hear in your discussion of you're talking about the imperialist things there earlier is the U.S. empire. U.S. has had an empire for well over 100 years. Come on.
Yeah,
100 years ago, they were doing, over 100 years ago. You've heard of the Philippines.
Well, right. Actually, the American empire as an empire really begins with the Spanish-American War, unless you count the seizure of a third of Mexico and the destruction of Native Americans to build the Sea Nation.
The seizure of, the Continental United States.
Well, so.
Well, I mean, like, for example, so you were, like, talking about Reagan or whatever, but it was going on 100 years before him.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like I say, the Philippines, Panama. You've heard of Panama, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and then the countries around Panama got impacted by that same, when the U.S. took...
Well, in fact, we kind of, Americans, had a role in creating Panama as a break-off part of Colombia.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I'd forgotten that.
Not to mention the various proxy wars that we have supported in Africa and in Southeast Asia and in other locales around the world.
The things that empires do.
Yeah.
Right.
The U.S. empire...
Okay. Well, that's cool.
Empire. Remember that.
Okay,
been
man.
One for a long time.
Yeah.
Over 100 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you very much
for the call. So the call is really saying, look, it's an empire. It's been an empire for a while. What we're seeing now, though, is a later stage of empire building and empire maintenance.
Yeah. there was a period in the Depression and for a few decades after, before capitalism became a truly global enterprise, when I think we, the taxpaying free citizens of the United States, could marshal a degree of political and economic clout such as to be able to improve conditions for the vast majority of working people. And we saw that happen with the union movement starting in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and on through the Depression and through the war and the post-war decades. I think historians will look back at that as a high watermark for liberal democracy in general and for the United States in particular. The decline of working class political and economic influence, I think, began in the early 1970s, was exacerbated by the conservative policies of Ronald Reagan, and has gone nowhere but south ever since then. And now that capitalism is a truly global system, that clout may be gone forever.
Well, I just a little self-promotion here. I'm going to be teaching a course at Portland State, History 329, during the summer, and we'll be talking about the U.S. history from 1960 to as far as we can get.
Oh, cool. That sounds really interesting.
It's going to be good.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Randy, good morning.
Hi. First off, building on the previous comment, the thing that I want to suggest is that the high point of the working class in the United States was probably in the mid-60s, and I take that by looking at the that's when men's wages peaked.
Right. That's when a dollar would go the farthest.
Well, it was more than that. I mean, we're not looking just at the GDP, right? But the actual wages for the lower quarter in the United States,
right?
And one major factor, and this is something that we need to be real about, okay, is that what happened in 1965 was a massive expansion of immigration, which tended to put a ceiling on wages, particularly for unskilled workers early on.
All right, so you're blaming the declining economic influence of the American working class on an influx of immigration?
I I'm saying that when you express it's a simple market thing, and Samuel Gompert, Cesar Chavez, and A. Philip Randolph would stand with me on this one, that when you expand the supply of labor, you lower the negotiating position of labor in a particular country.
Well, that would be true, except that it isn't. I mean, what really happened was a series of laws were passed, including the Taft-Hartley Act, which restricted the power of labor to organize. There was, in fact, a decrease in the significance of skilled labor, not because of appearance of outsiders or immigrants or whatever, but because the ability of industry to mechanize and to do away with skilled labor, and the ability of American industry to move overseas. So the labor, the cheap labor would be significant.
The trade deals were not effective. But I mean, I'm just saying, you need to read the economics on this one. Start looking at George Boris at Harvard, leading labor economist in the United States. And what he says, the impact of supply has done in the negotiating position.
So you're saying an increase in the labor pool tends to have a general downward effect on wages.
That
is true. But at the same time, a lessening of labor's ability to organize and negotiate for itself prevents any upward pressure on wages that we might have otherwise had.
That would also be true. And when you combine that with globalization and bad trade deals, all three work together.
Yes. Yes.
And then you can also combine it, and this is the other point that I think we need to make, is that, you know, when you look at there was a longstanding tactic of diversification of the workforce. This was a very conscious thing when you go back in the early 1900s in America to prevent organization. They basically found a more diverse workforce was harder to organize, and there were people quite consciously doing that. Okay, when you go back and look at the history of this one. Now, the thing when we go like in what happened in Boston recently, I think that we need a more comprehensive solution for the whole refugee issue than just like, oh, we're going to, you know, let a few people in to the United States. We get about 10 million applicants for immigration to the U.S. every year. We admit only about a million. And most of those people are admitted because they have relatives in the U.S. So the number of true refugees that are admitted are very, very small. And when I look at those young men, if anybody had talked to them, I mean, it was actually tragic to me when you actually read their comments about life in America for them. You know, they were in a situation they saw as a utter no-win situation to them. And if anybody had talked to them for 5 minutes in an entrance interview, this would have been obvious.
Well, wait a minute. You're throwing a lot of things together. I think it's important that people understand that I don't know the exact number, but the 15 million undocumented workers in the United States are essentially people doing tasks that don't pay a living wage for most other people. And that in reality, the technical jobs, the really highly skilled and highly paid jobs in the U.S., have shrunk tremendously. In fact, even in working on the line in the auto industry and so on, that the skills that are part of the American working class are being essentially made redundant and irrelevant because decisions have been made on the part of monopoly capital to find markets overseas and find ways to make things cheaper overseas. And that has nothing really to do with immigration.
Well, it does in the sense that, for example, if you look at the decline of the high-tech industry in the U.S., H-1B, which was a program of indentured servitude, played a major factor in displacing U.S. tech workers.
The H-1B immigrant worker visa?
It's a temporary visa. It's technically a non-immigrant visa, but most people that get it eventually do get a green card. And it was basically...
You called it an indentured servitude program. I'm a little confused about that.
Basically, somebody signs on to having 6 years. You have to keep your job for 6 years. At the end of 6 years,
I see what you're saying.
You can get, but in the meantime, you change jobs only with great difficulty. You can, but it's hard.
I get what you're saying, but I really want to peel the question of the role of undocumented workers and families, and this is really important, families who live in the United States, by the way, out of in terms of history, these are peoples who, had it not been for American imperialism, would be part of I don't know what, Mexico and the U.S. But if you really peel that away from what's happening on the larger economic scale worldwide, it's a drop in the bucket. It's not the most significant thing. It's particularly not the most significant thing when the great majority of those workers really are doing the jobs that pay the least and are the least useful.
Well, first off, every job category that undocumented workers work in, the majority of people working in it are in fact legal U.S. residents or U.S. citizens. Every single one.
Okay, well, we're going to – I want to thank you. We're going to move on to other people. There's a lot of people backing up here, and we're running out of time.
One more thing I want to throw in here. The show was originally going to be about a whole bunch of things that happened in the month of April that illustrated the many problems facing our republic at the moment. Yeah, one of those things – I just want to throw this out there because I found it particularly galling – was the rash of Bush administration revisionism that's going on in the wake of the opening of the Bush presidential library in Texas. A whole bunch of whitewashing.
I don't know what there's nothing,
George Bush's two terms.
Bush didn't read. How can they have a library?
I know, it's ironic. It's ironic on so many levels. I don't want to get into it. I just want to throw it out there.
Okay, and I want to mention a couple of things before we run out of time. I want to mention the special meeting for anyone interested in KBOO this Saturday, May 4th, at 1 o'clock at the Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont here in Portland. It's really important, if you care about the station, to be there. A lot of changes are possible, and a lot of changes may happen, and you need to be part of that discussion. The second thing is I want to mention the May Day rally beginning, let's say, at 3 o'clock at the O'Brien Square at 9th and Stark, and there's going to be a march also at 4 o'clock. And it's always cool. It's always fun. And you should bring your kids.
Yeah, it's a good time. All right, let's go back to the phones.
Hello.
Anybody? Got a phone caller, Steve. David, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, all this talk about problems with the Republic, do you ever think that that's exactly what they want all of us to be spending our time talking about?
Who's the they there?
The plutocrats to deflect us from the real issues. I mean, this previous caller, why is everyone blaming the problems on immigrants?
Yeah, that's weird.
We spend so much money overseas on wars and countries. It's because the plutocrats need it for the business and the corporations and the war industrialists. And do you ever know who owns most of our media? It's GE, which is the world's largest military supplier in the world. I mean, where does that come across? Like, if we're watching TV and they say we have a threat from some country, well, it's the war industrialists and plutocrats want us to believe that. And they want us to fight the Republicans and Democrats. They want us to fight and blame to deflect from what their agenda is. I mean, Bush isn't any worse or better than Obama.
Oh, yeah, he was worse.
No, look what Obama's doing. There's no civil rights. He doesn't torture. He just kills. And now the filibuster by Rand Paul, it took 16 hours for the Obama administration to finally say, yes, we can't legally kill Americans in the U.S. Okay, I mean, that's what it's taken now.
Sure. Let me just jump in to say, I both agree and disagree with you. Yes, I think the plutocrats, as you term it, which is a pretty apt term, want us to be talking about just about everything except them. But I think on the programs like this, where we're talking about the plutocrats being the problem, I don't think that's the conversation that they want us to have.
Right, exactly. Yes. And we are not a democracy. This is not a democracy. This is a plutocracy. And we're run by the corporate entities. And our whole foreign policy, that's why Obama bails out all these different companies, Wall Street and cars, and we're going to war and we'll go to Syria here because the plutocrats, the oil people, have his ear. We have to get to Syria. We have to go. And you know, this North Korea, South Korea, that relic from 50 years ago, that was plutocracy. We need to control those Asians out there, and they're communists, so we're going to keep our military entrenched there for 100 years. I mean, we need to wake up and say it's not the immigrants, it's not people who want food stamps, it's not people who want unemployment, it's the people shipping these huge amounts of our treasure overseas.
It's the 1%.
Yes.
Yes.
And, you know, we need to, this whole setup is not a democracy.
Listen, thank you so much for the call. I want to try and get to a couple more before the end. Appreciate your comments.
Appreciate you got your form. You guys are awesome.
Hey, thanks so much. All right, let's get one more in. Huh?
Come
in. Who's up next, Steve? Marie, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I love your program. You guys are the best. So the two points I want to make is that the very terrible things that have been happening the last few weeks are the new news on Hanford, as we know, the Physician for Social Responsibility display going on. But that is actually linked to the fluoride issue because there's information that people that are affected with their thyroid from the radiation coming from Japan, that is a connection to fluoride because fluorine and iodine are in the same family on the periodic chart. And so the radioactive material can, the fluoride can help interfere with the thyroid. So people that have thyroid conditions or worsening thyroid conditions from Fukushima can actually be much more harmed by fluoride. And there's one more point even worse than that. And I have a lot of information to give you all. I can send you quite a bit of information. People that have mercury fillings are very much harmed by fluoride. And I know KBOO did some old programs on mercury. I don't know if you guys can check the archives, but people that have mercury fillings can be very seriously affected by the fluoride.
Okay, so I'm sorry. We're going to have to leave it there. We're simply
out of
time.
I really appreciate you. Next week, we will be talking about the fluoride issue.
Yes, please call us back. Thanks, everybody. That was a very interesting discussion, kind of wide-ranging, but an important conversation to be had.
All right. You stay tuned to KBOO, and you show up for the big meeting on Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Tune in Wednesday, May 1st at 6 p.m. for the monthly episode of Treasures from the KBOO Vault. This month, we'll listen to Ursula K. Le Guin, Portland-based writer and all-around cultural icon. We'll hear an interview done in 1993 at the release of the book Blue Moon Over Thurman Street, and we'll hear her read a story recorded in September 1992 from Sea Road. That's this Wednesday, May 1st at 6 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's a minute after 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on Alternative Radio, host David Barsamian interviews Yves Engler about what's going on in Canada. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, an interview with Charlie Kernaghan of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights on the rising death toll for the Bangladesh garment factory collapse, and an interview with former bank consultant and longtime thrift watchdog Tim Anderson about reports that Obama is poised to nominate subprime queen Penny Pritzker to be the next Secretary of Commerce. At 11 on Stage and Studio, D.May Roberts talks with author Ursula K. Le Guin, director Jonathan Walters, and actor Damian Thompson about a new original stage adaptation of Le Guin's novel The Left Hand of Darkness by Portland Playhouse and Hand to Mouth Theater. At 11:30 on Art Focus, Ava Lake interviews Patrick Collier. He has a show at Place right now. He also writes for Oregon Arts Watch and other publications. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our spring membership drive. If you missed it, you can go to kboo.fm and join by clicking on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
No. No, the Harper government has, in as part of this pulling out of the Kyoto Protocol, part of their support for the tar sands industry has been an aggressive cutting of a slew of different programs that deal with climate change or climate disturbances, the research element. And it's actually prompted fairly significant protests from scientists.
That's Eve Engler. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Eve Engler on what's going on in Canada. What's going on in Canada? Justin Bieber, snow, hockey? Since 2006, the vast country of 35 million people has been led by Stephen Harper. He's the Prime Minister and head of the Conservative Party. Earlier in his political career, he was a member of parliament representing Calgary in Alberta province. To say Harper has close ties with Canada's powerful oil and mining interests would be an understatement. He is a fervent advocate of the tar sands project in Alberta and has aggressively backed its expansion. Scientists such as James Hansen calls the extraction of this particularly dirty oil a monster and game over for stabilizing the climate. Harper is strongly backing the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline from Alberta to the U.S. Gulf Coast. That project, opposed by many in the United States, is on Obama's desk right now. Our guest today is Eve Engler. He's been called one of the most important voices on the Canadian left today, and in the mold of I.F. Stone. He's the author of many books, including Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, Canada-Israel Building Apartheid, and The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. I talked with Eve Engler in Toronto. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So who is the ugly Canadian? Who is Stephen Harper? What are his political origins?
Well, I think Stephen Harper's foreign policy is not something that's completely distinct from previous Canadian government's foreign policies. But it's a particularly ideological bunch that are in power today, very close to the tar sands oil interests and a couple decades of sort of right-wing ideology that comes with the oil sector in Alberta. And also, I think it's a foreign policy that is very close with the rise of Canadian mining companies around the world. And Canadian mining companies have